Okay, it's Thursday night, question night, and this is the final time I am going to answer these questions, because tomorrow night I have to go to Dhammaloka Centre in Ollamar to give the Friday night talk. But please write your questions down, because tomorrow we have panel. We're going to answer the questions. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. So that'd be fun and games. I wish I was here to see that. Hope it's recorded. So, no, record it, please. Yes, I can use that for entertainment. No, I think it'll be good fun tomorrow night. So when you actually write the questions tomorrow night, sort of actually you can actually put down to which one you want it to. So okay. So the middle monk, sort of the next monk, the big monk. Be careful about what you ask the big monk. He's a big fellow. Or Sister Naroda, Sister Mudita. Anyway, here we go. Dear Ajahn, now question number one. Is it possible to remember past lives when you were born in another realm? If yes, wouldn't that be a bit freaky if you were reborn in a hell realm or as an animal? Can you recollect and return knowledge learnt in past lives? Yeah, actually, sometimes people have been reborn in a dog in their last life, and that's why you can really sleep very well. That's a skill which you remember very well. And so, sometimes people will be reborn as an alligator in their past life, and that's why they can eat so much. So there's certain skills, and sometimes people were born as a crow in their previous life. That's why they talk so badly about others. Yeah, no, sometimes, I remember this one fellow who said he could remember, like, what was it, being reborn as, I think it was a pig or a goat or something. And he recalled it and said it was just like really, like real dullness his mind was when he was reborn in that state. So yeah, people actually can remember that, but obviously it's not as clear as, say, a life in the human realm or in the Deva realms. But even the Deva realms, because it's so almost like foreign to your everyday experience, you can't really make too much sense of it. Because the way we interpret things, it's hard enough when you get into deep meditation, you're still like a human being, and you get these experiences, and what does it actually mean? How is it? Sometimes it's so hard to interpret when it's foreign from your ordinary daily existence. So it's like a person, say, lives in Australia all their life, and they go to, say, Africa, they get culture shock. And they can't really make sense of the things around them because it's so different. The language is different, the temperatures are different, the scenery is different. And then you imagine that sort of culture shock you get by just going to a strange place. And this is actually where you go in your memories. You go to such a strange place, you can't really make too much sense out of it. So that's why it's very difficult to actually experience those past lives as other beings, simply because they're so different and it makes it hard for you to gain that perception through which you can understand what was going on. So that's my answer. Can anyone here remember their past lives as a dog or a cat? No. I know there's some people here. And I remember somebody once said that in their next life they want to be reborn as a dog. What do you want to be reborn as a dog for? And they said, because I don't have to go to work on a Monday morning. Can lie around all day and just get fed 3 times a day and play. But then I told them, what happens to dogs in Australia? They have to go to the vet, first of all, for the operation. And they said, I don't want to be a dog next life. There are advantages, but there's disadvantages. Okay, dear Ajahn, I find this present moment, no past nor future, still elusively slippery. It is sometimes here, then sometimes there, but then how do I know it is still here before moving there, and it may still be here? Is it inside or outside the body or the mind? Maybe it's just a knowing, an awareness, no thinking, just a knowing. Where am I now with no thoughts of the past or future? Just here, where? In the present moment, does this make sense? No. I'd appreciate further guidance, please. Okay. Okay, sometimes if you think too much, it gets really hopeless. Remember, present moment is not a thought. It's like a perception, a feeling. It's a consciousness, not thought. So if you think about it, sometimes it's too hard for actually to pinpoint. But you know you're in the present moment. You know, when you're eating your favorite food, or you're drinking a cup of tea, just right now you can taste it in the mouth. You're in the present moment. You're paying attention, and there's no thoughts of the past or anything of the future. You're here now. So the best way of knowing the present moment is when all the past is gone, and all the future is also gone, what's left must be now. So you can know it by exclusion. When all the past has disappeared, and all the present, sorry, and all the past is gone, and all the future is not yet here. You're not paying attention to the future or the past. What's left is we call now. The present moment. So it's just when you're paying full attention, you're right here in the moment. Sometimes that people like listening to like classical music, because that brings them into the moment, because every notes are changing so fast. You have to be in this moment to be able to listen to it and follow it. If you miss one moment, you've sort of lost the whole movement. So whatever is, when you're right there in the action, life as it happens, not recorded highlights, not previews of what's coming in a cinema near you soon, but actually the present moment, live as it happens. That's called now. Does that make any sense? Well, look, if you don't understand the present moment now, you will understand it later. If you know what I mean. You get to know it after a while. In the present moment, if it becomes familiar, it's one of those things, meditation things, you learn through experience, but not through thinking. Dear Ajahn, I produce fruit enzymes by fermenting... this is amazing, interesting. I don't know what this is about meditation, but anyway. I produce fruit enzymes by fermenting fruits like papayas, pineapples, grapes, kiwis, etc. I drink the fruit enzyme as a means of detoxification. However, as the fermentation process will result in the production of some alcohol, will this be considered an intoxicating drink, which is not allowed according to the precepts? Well, it can't be intoxicating if you're detoxicating. So I don't know which intoxicating it is. But find out whether it's intoxicating or detoxicating. If more toxins are going out than going in, it must be okay. So basically, the Buddha said, if it's going to make you a little bit tiddly or sort of even drunk, then don't take it. And sometimes it depends on your sensitivity. Because, I actually don't mind telling you who one of those monks was in this story, because he was here just a few days ago. Not Ajahn Yana, but Ajahn Pasano. Many, many years ago, he was in Thailand with me, and he got some sweets from his mother in Canada. They were wine gums. And he thought wine gums, they're just sweets. So he shared it with his mates, about three other monks. But it was real wine in them. Now, these were monks who hadn't had any alcohol for years. And when you don't have alcohol for years, just a small amount, you're very, very sensitive. And these four monks started getting very, very funny. They weren't totally drunk, but they were halfway there. And they found out afterwards, actually, these wine gums from Canada had real wine in them. So those poor monks, never let them forget that. They sort of got semi-drunk. But it was obviously, they had no intention of doing that. They just thought it was sweets. They never thought it was real alcohol. But the best story, I hope these monks tell stories about me as well. You know, the other monk who was here a few days ago, Ajahn Nyanadamo, that he was coming from Adelaide once. And he was sitting on a plane, there's this guy sitting next to him, he boarded in Adelaide, and he saw like a monk sitting next to him, and he sort of poured his heart out you know, to the monk throughout the whole journey from Adelaide to Perth. Not too late. But he said too long. But he said he was really, really scared of flying. He was terrified of flying. He had a psychosis about flying. And the only way he'd get through the journey is having whiskey after whiskey after whiskey, which is like free on the flight sometime. So he's drinking all this whiskey and talking to Ajahn Yanadamma all the time. And obviously, in 2 hours from Adelaide to Perth, he was getting really quite drunk. And he had a whiskey in his hand. He was already sort of a bit wobbly. And then he hit turbulence. And so guess where that whiskey went? Right over Ajahn Yana's robe. So when we picked him up from the airport, he smelled like a distillery. And that's the story he gave. You get into some fine pickles, as they say, when you're a monk. So as long as you don't get intoxicated by, you know, having that fermented stuff, that's okay. Dear Ajahn, I am living with two people who says that my perception of them is always 99% wrong. Knowing how it feels to be told that my perception is only 1% correct, I did not have the heart to tell them that their perception of me is not right all the time as well. Because they think that you're wrong 99% of the time, and that's 99% wrong, because their perception of you is 99% wrong. So where does that leave you? What's 99% of 99%? I don't know. Anyway, I think the state of mind one is in affects perception. Having the wrong perception has created many harmful speech in this small community. How do I bring practice into a situation like this? Because you're not sure whether your perception is right or wrong. Shut up. That's the best thing. Because you don't know what a person is, or why they're talking, or if they're talking, why they're acting, or not they're talking. So I just give them the 1% benefit of the doubt. That's always the best. So you see someone misbehaving, oh, there must be some reason for that. If they're talking to each other, oh, there must be some reason to that. It's not your business. So your business is to perceive yourself and to make sure that that perception of yourself is pretty accurate with strong mindfulness. And you'll see what other people do, that's their karma, that's their business. And why should I allow what other people do to affect my happiness and my peace? As one of my common sayings, never allow anybody to control your happiness. So whatever they do, whatever they say, that's their business. I'm going to be happy, I'm going to enjoy my retreat, in spite of everybody else. And that way, sort of, you're free. You're not being controlled by other people's misbehavior or good behavior. We don't know which one it is. So just leave it alone. Stop perceiving other people. Because you don't know what they're doing or why they're doing it. There might be a good reason somewhere. That makes any sense? The best thing is that be quiet. So, you know, stop sort of complaining and criticizing people or saying things. Dear Ajahn Brahm, Ajahn mentioned Devadatta. If he had psychic powers, he must have got jhanas, abandoned ego and self, or see the letting go. And he would have had to listen to the Buddha's teaching. How he could have strayed so much from the path. Okay, to get jhanas, you don't have to abandon your ego completely once and forever. Sometimes people can push that letting go button by chance. They can fluke it, and sometimes they do. And the point is that you may have, before you get into that jhana, you may be surrendering, making peace, getting yourself nice and still and calm, and you get into these very, very powerful stages. And sometimes afterwards you think, wow, I've got this incredible state of mind. You know, I must be enlightened, and I must be much better than everybody else. And this is a true story of my first year as a monk. This happened just before I went to Ajahn Chah's monastery, but I saw this monk afterwards, and they told me what had just happened maybe a week or two before I arrived. That this is a disciple of Ajahn Chah, he started to get some really, really deep meditations, you know, these jhana things, and he started developing the psychic power of being able to hear sounds a long way away. And, you know, he was in Wat Ba Phong, and he could hear what the conversations going on in Warin, about 6 kilometers away. And they checked him out, and it was true, he could hear these things. he started getting these powers. But then his pride, spiritual pride, got so strong, he started sitting in Ajahn Chah's chair. So, you know, I'm sort of more powerful than Ajahn Chah. And as soon as they saw that, you know, they realized the fellow was going a bit, you know, too egocentric. And so the monks told him off, and he realized his mistake. And the following morning, in the eating hall, he bowed to every monk, about 60 monks, and asked forgiveness of everybody. It took a long time. And then he went really, really quiet. And he never said anything, and he was just a very good monk from then on. Because what happens is sometimes you get these powerful states of mind. It's very easy, if you haven't got a good teacher around on top of you, to think, oh, I'm enlightened now, or I'm powerful now, or, you know, I'm the top. Sometimes one of the dangers of the jhanas is spiritual pride. You think you're almost enlightened, because it's a powerful experience. So that's what happened to Devadatta. He got these amazing powers with his jhana, and he thought he was better than the Buddha. Remember, that had been an underlying trait in him for a long time, always been competing with the Buddha, growing up with him, and always being number two. And now, you know, he thought he was number one. And that spiritual pride is what sort of stopped him going that further distance to enlightenment. So he didn't even have stream meaning. He had the jhanas, it was very, very close on the door, but the spiritual pride stopped him going through. So that's what sometimes happens. Remember, the ego is so strong, you can take something like a spiritual attainment and think you're so great and so good. Which is another reason why we keep that quiet. We don't tell people, you know, when we attain these things, because that helps to keep the spiritual pride and ego sort of subdued. Okay, so that sometimes happens. So it's not as if that they completely let go of the ego. They suppressed the ego for a while, got into a jhana, and then for these people the ego came back with force. And they took that jhana experience as another attainment for themselves, as a superior being, so they thought. Make sense? Okay, here comes next question. For one to move in and out of jhanas in meditation, does one need to build the capacity to tolerate high levels of emotion, be it positive or negative feeling, in the body and mind, while still remaining equanimous in one's daily life experiences, not just in the moment of meditation? And does one need to develop a worldview of very, very strong renunciation in one's daily affairs to narrow the gap between daily life outside the meditation and entering the jhanas in meditation? Okay, so what happens first of all, that people get into jhanas and they've still got lots of attachments and they still get sad, but once you get these things more and more, you become less concerned with things in the world, because you've got these beautiful jhanas. And what do you want to worry about things in the world for when you've got these wonderful blisses of jhanas? So first of all, you do tend to actually to live a more simple life, not to get involved in so many things, and also not to get attached to so many things. So you live more simply. And you see, you don't get upset by so many people and, you know, you're getting attached to your family or your things. You're just much more free and happy, because you realize that those material possessions aren't so important to you. And as wisdom grows more and more, you tend to sort of, you know, let those things go, not worry about them so much. But the other part of the question here, that do you need to build a capacity to tolerate high levels of emotion, be it positive or negative feelings? Negative feelings, once you get into jhanas, negative feelings don't really get very strong at all, but the positive ones get incredibly strong. And so there is like a bit of insight in that question that, yeah, you get the ability to have these incredibly powerful states of mind and be peaceful with them, not to be afraid by them. Because just before you get into these jhanas, even when you get into nimittas, we always say this is two big obstacles to the attainment of the jhanas. And one of them is fear, the other one is excitement. Because you're really getting somewhere. And sometimes that's excitement, the wow factor. It's incredible, it's amazing. And when you get excited like that, it spoils the stillness and the peace and of course the whole thing falls apart. And the other one, and I think the other one is probably more common for people, is fear. Because these are incredibly powerful states. And sometimes people think they can't handle this amount of power. Because it's true, you can't control it, and it's that controller business. It's too big for me, too strong for me. But the more you let go, who cares whether you can handle it or not? It's just power, it's just bliss, it's just very strong, that's all. Remember, the only thing about emotions is when we try and control them, it makes them much worse. If you feel sad and you want to cry, but you try and control yourself, it makes it worse. If you're getting blissed out and you try and control it, it gets really unstable. So you learn how to just go with your emotions rather than controlling them. To allow them to be. And if you can do that with the very strong emotions, they get stronger and stronger and take you into these incredible strong bliss states. And they are emotional states. So you do need a facility to actually to be at ease with your emotions and not to control them. Which is, and I say this every retreat, and it seems to be so far from my experience backed up, women seem to have a better job, easier time getting into jhanas than men. So the females here, you're ahead of the game. But don't worry, because the men, once they do get into the jhanas, they've got an easier time figuring out what it means and getting enlightened. So they catch up afterwards. So the women get in there first, but then the men figure it out exactly what it is. And get to enlightenment at the same time. So it balances. But I think one of the reasons why women seem to get into jhanas more, I think is basically, this is only my sort of theory, is that they have a better grasp and ease with the emotional world. And so they can let go and feel their way into jhanas instead of thinking and questioning so much on what's happening on the way in. These are feely-feely states. So you've got to be a feely-feely person to get into the feely-feely jhanas. Any comments on that?
Just the first part of that question, the strong pronunciation, does the person, if they're moving into those states or going close to moving into those states, are they... You know how the Buddha said, what the world says is good, is pleasurable, but the development say is not?
Yeah.
Is a person moving along to that end of the continuum in that sort of perceptual world?
Okay, the more times you experience those jhanas, or the closer you get to those jhanas repeatedly, then you won't be so attracted to the ordinary things in life, the things which would turn you on before you think, oh, what's the point? So you do sort of turn away from the pleasures of the world, and you turn more to the pleasures of the mind, because it's more enjoyable. So if you've got the choice between a jhana and sex, have jhana please. So obviously that you'll be turning away. Now be careful, those of you who've got a marriage which is going very well, if you get into too many jhanas on this retreat, oh, you may be in trouble. You may cite me in your divorce papers. Before, I used to love my husband very much, but now I love jhanas much more. It's all because of Ajahn Brahm. But that's unlikely you get into jhanas that much. But if you do, it doesn't matter. You're having a great time anyway.
It should be led by that process that you just described.
Yeah, that is.
Bliss rather than renunciation or the decision to restrain senses.
Okay, it should not be led by negativity, by this like Puritan piety, that you know, if you enjoy it, it must be bad for you, and sort of sex is bad, and getting rich is bad, and watching movies is bad, and watching the TV is bad. All that sort of stuff, which sometimes people think, now, I'm a good Buddhist. I don't watch TV. I don't watch movies. You know, I meditate and chant every morning. I haven't got even TV in my house. And I eat vegetarian food. And I go to the temple every Friday night. And I just, sometimes people have that spiritual piety, you know, the Puritan sort of ethic. But it's not through negativity. It's just for this gentle, this is just where I incline towards. It's not controlled. It's natural.
It would be pretty important to get the balance right and be really straight with yourself about that, because if you get it wrong, you've got the royal road to clinical depression.
Yeah, you probably have. but it's a natural. As long as you remember the instructions and just do it like naturally, calmly, gently, then you usually can't go wrong. But if people go hell for leather for jhanas, it's like an attainment, you know, another sort of feather in your cap. You know, you've got your degrees, you've got your mansion, you've got your car, now I'm going to go for jhanas. And you're not going to stop until you get them. No one's going to stand in your way. And with that sort of attitude, you know, you usually can't get there anyway, but if anyone does even get close, they've got spiritual pride. Anyway, the next question. Dear Ajahn, I really treasured my time here at the retreat. You gone already? To have time out from our daily busy lives to enjoy the inner peace is priceless. When the new retreat centre is up and running, is it possible to have longer retreats, like 2 weeks to a month? When you can do a 9-day retreat, then maybe you can do a 2-month retreat. Whoever wrote this has already left after 7 days. So be able to complete a 9-day retreat first, then you can think of 2 months. But yeah, that's one of the reasons. So we could really benefit from them, as long as it doesn't tire the teachers and retreat managers. Now, once we get our own retreat centre, we can do things like that. So we can, you know, the idea is you can have your 9-day retreats, and that's taught like we're doing here. And if you have time, you want to stay on, carry on afterwards. You don't always have to have the teacher being there. They're giving a talk, because after the retreat, you know, the monk or the nun or the lay person or whoever's doing the teaching, they can go away and you can just carry on with your own momentum. There's so many talks on MP3 and on the computer. Gee, you've got so many talks. You've got a whole library of talks. You can play yourself one every night. Sometimes I thought like that, having sort of this robot of Ajahn Brahm or sort of Ajahn Wham or Ajahn everyone, and just, you know, just press the buttons. And you get the talk, even so many talks. What talk do you want tonight? And you just press the button and it just comes out, the recorded ones. You know, your favourite hits or whatever. But anyhow, that would be a possibility with the retreat centre, because we manage it. And it's ours, we can do whatever we want. And obviously there won't be retreats, you know, every 9 days. There'll be only for like a few a year, and there'll be a few run by other groups, but you can carry on. And sometimes, if you have the time, you can come a little bit earlier. And then 3 or 4 days earlier, settle in and do a bit of meditation. So when the ordinary retreat starts, you're already ahead. So we have, like, flexibility when it's our own retreat centre. But you know, here, we haven't got any flexibility at all. We've got to get out, I think, by 3:30. So they can clean up for the next thing, whatever. So, no, it's very hard when it's not your own retreat centre. But with our own retreat centre, we're going to produce more jhana freaks, more enlightened people in our world. So it's much easier. So that's coming soon. Ah, here we go. There are, O monks, these 4 modes of progress. What for? The mode of progress that is painful with sluggish direct knowledge. The mode of progress that is painful with quick direct knowledge. The mode of progress that is pleasant with sluggish direct knowledge. And the mode of progress that is pleasant with quick direct knowledge. Please, Ajahn, could you explain carefully, in brief, slow and painful, sort of slow and happy, fast and painful, or fast and happy? So which one do you want? When I read that, I said, I'll take the fast and happy, please. And the fast and happy, it depends upon the power of your defilements and also the strength of what we call the spiritual qualities. Those spiritual qualities are centered, it's on the 5 of them if you want to know them, is faith, energy, mindfulness, stillness and wisdom. Now, if those are very, very strong, it's a fast path. And here on this retreat, I've really focused on that central one, the mindfulness, making that very, very strong. So you really are aware, you rest, develop this strong mindfulness so you feel awake, the mind is energized, you can actually see clearly, the food tastes better, the carpet looks beautiful. That shows a strong mindfulness. Now that's the power which makes the path fast, by developing strong mindfulness. If that works, you're awake, you can see the breath, and it's very easy to watch. But when the mindfulness is dull and you know, it's not really sort of clear, you don't know what you're doing, you waste a lot of time. So build up that mindfulness first of all, and I told you how to do that by being still, not doing so much, not fighting so much, resting the body, making peace with the mind. And the mindfulness gets very strong, you can catch things so quickly. You know, any sort of defilement which comes out, you can see it and get rid of it. So that's the speed, comes from the power of your mindfulness, with the other things as well, the faith and the energy. The energy also comes from stillness, the stillness and the wisdom. And whether it's a suffering path or a happy path depends upon the strength of your defilements, your sexual desire, your sensuality, and your ill will, your fault-finding mind. If those are long ingrained in you, and you are such a sensuous person, and you get upset and angry at the least things, then your path, it may be fast, it may be slow, but it will be painful. I don't want to give up my sex. I don't want to give up my nice food. I don't want to give up. And those people who keep talking and snoring, they shouldn't be allowed to go in a retreat. I've got their names, I'm going to tell Ajahn Brahm afterwards. You're going to blacklist them, so they can never come on a retreat ever again. So that's like that ill will. And that means the whole retreat is painful. You're making problems for yourself. So it's the ill will and the sensory desire, the strength of that, makes it painful or makes it happy. So if you've got like few defilements, you're not really, no, you're just ordinary sensual desire, you know, you like nice food or comfort, but you know, you're not really so much into it, you have to have this, you have to have that. And you don't have any ill will, or just have ordinary amounts, you don't really get too upset what other people do and say, and you just sort of can be quite forgiving, then you have a happy path. So there you got a choice, which one you want to take. If you're going to be angry, fault-finding and sensuous, it's going to be a struggle. Just let it go and it's so happy. And if you have lots of mindfulness, it's fast. You don't have to wait so long. So that's the fast path and the happy path, which is what we teach here. So hopefully you've, on the fast path to enlightenment, have a happy time in this retreat, and almost there, you're on the last lap to enlightenment. So please, don't leave the circuit before the last lap happens. Any comments or questions about that? Yes?
Doesn't mindfulness weaken the defilements?
It does weaken the defilements, certainly it does, because you see them and you can knock them out. So mindfulness is very, very good. But what is mindfulness? It has to be the strong awareness. Ordinary mindfulness doesn't work because you miss too much. So just be mindful, it's not good enough. You've got to, how can I be mindful? And the energy, hopefully you've experienced, some of you hope have experienced that, the different levels of mindfulness. That sometimes you come and sat here and you're just so alert. You can watch things so easily. And the mind is bright and happy. And there's other times you get here and it's dull, you just can't see really much what you're doing. So you can't even find the breath. And if you do find the breath, you can't keep it very long, because the lights are not bright in your mind. So that's what I mean by the power of mindfulness. It's a very important thing to notice. And once you notice the different levels of power in mindfulness, then you can notice what brightens the mindfulness and what weakens it. And hopefully you get that insight that too much controlling, doing, struggling actually weakens mindfulness. And just leaving it alone, letting go, being still, making peace, being kind, being gentle, strengthens mindfulness. When you find that, you know how to create that strong mindfulness, which is makes the path very fast, but also makes it pretty happy as well. Dear Ajahn, this is not really a question, so then I won't answer it. That's what it started off with. I just want to say that there is kindness in people here. 2 days ago, a retreatant lady suddenly approached my fiancé and offered to, what, to marry her? No, to lend us her better coal-suited jackets. Oh, isn't that kind? Probably she had noticed how unaccustomed we were to the cold, having come from hot weather place. Her thoughts and act of kindness have touched us deeply, and we are truly grateful to her sincerity. May she and everyone in the retreat here be well and happy. You see, that's very nice. So someone was mindful and sensitive enough to see someone who was cold and offer them their jacket. Isn't that very nice? I would have offered my robe, but it's the only one I've got. And then they would have to come up here and give the talk. Ajahn, could you please introduce the Venerables to us? Tomorrow night you'll find out all about them. Yeah. Someone might as well do it now. Just on the far right of the team is Sister Mudita. She only ordained as a nun, how long, about a month ago? 6 weeks? 2 months ago. So she's a baby nun. Very old to be baby nun. But there we have Sister Niroda. You've been, how long are you, is it?
4 years.
4 years as a nun.
Junior nun.
Well, sort of middle. And we have Venerable Radha. How long have you been a monk now? A couple of years. So he's like still junior nun. Junior monk, sorry. And we have Venerable Vimoka, who is very much a baby monk, because he only got a day last week, wasn't it? Yes. And we've got very, very baby novice, Asaji, who only got ordained again last week. So we have some very young, talented, bright, and wise monks and nuns to answer your question tomorrow. Okay. Hey Ajahn, could you please explain the wisdom aspect of the Noble Eightfold Path? That's a great question. Where does that live in the Noble Eightfold Path? You got right view, but is that wisdom? You got right intention, but is that wisdom? You got speech, action, livelihood, that's 3, 4, 5. You've got right effort, right mindfulness, right jhana, stillness. Where does wisdom come in the Eightfold Path? But that's not in the Eightfold Path, that's after the Eightfold Path. Because the answer to that question is a great question. When I was reading Anguttara Nikaya, I just couldn't find the Eightfold Path in the eights where I thought it would be. Because the Anguttara Nikaya, this whole section of Dhamma, they have like the one this, the two that, the three that, the four that. So you get three refuges, you get five precepts in the fives, you get the four satipatthanas in the fours. And, you know, where you'd expect these to be, that's where you find them. But in the eights, there was no Eightfold Path. I kept on reading, and there it was in the tens. Because they added two extra factors. After the eighth factor, after the jhana, there's a new sequence. One after the other leads to the next. After the last factor of the Eightfold Path, right, so-called concentration, I like calling it stillness now, samasamadhi, which is jhanas, then you get right liberation, vimutti. And from that you get the knowledge of liberation. The insight of liberation comes afterwards. So this is actually where it comes from. They have usually in Buddhism sila, samadhi, panya, virtue, meditation and wisdom. And the real wisdom comes after the meditation. So the Eightfold Path just leads up to the meditation, the jhanas. And the wisdom comes next. So the Eightfold is the path, how you get there. And the goal is the wisdom. So this is the route, and the destination is the wisdom, which creates enlightenment. That's where it all fits in. So the insight comes just after the Eightfold Path. Eightfold Path is a way to somewhere. And where you're going is wisdom and enlightenment. Interesting question. Did you know that before? It's amazing what you learn on these 9-day retreats. Okay, the next question is coming up. Dear Ajahn, what is a skillful way to not take the criticism of other people too personally? Will sending them loving kindness make them less critical? It won't make them less critical, but just think of them as stupid. What do they know? In other words, the criticism of other people, how do they know what you did and why you did it? See, because sometimes we're so easy to criticise. How many times have people criticised you if you got it completely wrong? I don't know how many times I've said something stupid and thought, wow, that was really wise, some people said. And they praise me for things I just do not deserve. But it sounds good. So sometimes I realise people criticise me unfairly. And sometimes I say something, you know, really good and people don't understand the thing of being stupid. I know from my own life that so often I'm criticised completely wrongly. I'm praised for things I don't deserve and I'm blamed for things I didn't do. Can you relate to that? So that's what happens when people criticise you. So don't criticise other people, you're just joining the same game of inaccurate criticism. So if people do criticise you, instead of getting angry, what you should do is remember Ajahn Chah's famous simile of the dog. If someone calls you a dog, which is a simile for being criticised, if someone calls you a dog, you should look at your bottom to see if you have a tail. If you haven't got a tail, you're not a dog. So what's the problem? They got it wrong. But if you find there is a tail there, and you are a dog, you say, thank you, sir, madam. Yes, you were right, I am a dog. I never realised that. Thank you so much. And so obviously, if someone criticises you, listen to it, and if it makes sense, yeah, they have pointed out something you didn't see, thank them. I didn't realise I was doing that. But a lot of the time, you haven't got a tail. So you're not a dog, so they criticise you and say, I'm sorry, so you're wrong. You don't need to get upset when people criticise you and get angry. Gee, the number of times people criticised me in the early years here for dressing like a girl, because that's what they thought, dressed in these robes, I'm wearing a skirt. The number of times people would shout out and criticise you was sort of heaps. These days they don't do it. I remember once getting on a bus, sort of going from the city into our centre in North Perth, and these kids were on the bus. Now these young hooligans, maybe 16 or 17, 18, just like when I was 16 or 17, 18, young hooligan, and they started sort of criticising me. Say, hey, baldy, you're wearing a dress. So I just had fun. I just actually criticised them back. Hey, you long-haired sort of girly, get your hair cut. Or whatever. And as soon as I started giving as good as I got, they shut up. Sometimes they thought it was really strange being criticised by a monk. I was just having fun. They're having fun. I was having fun. So we both enjoyed it. But the point is that why get upset when you get criticised? Oh, just laugh at it. And I remember that story in the book where I still remember this at North Perth, because this was the earliest days when we were our first centre in Perth. And I remember just loading up our vehicle with building materials, because we were building our monastery down at Serpentine. Loading it up. And there must have been a girl visiting her granny in the house next door. She's about 14 years of age. And she came out and looked at me with her hands on her hips in utter disgust. Looked me up and down and sort of crunched her nose up and said, you're dressed like a girl. That's sick. Yuck. She really tried to upset me, but I thought it was so funny. I burst out laughing. And I thanked her because that's a nice story for my repertoire. So a lot of time when people really get upset at you and start criticising you, sometimes it's just so funny. So anyway, that's a skillful way to take criticism. Don't take it personally. You think, yeah, look at your bottom, see if you're a dog. See if it fits. If it doesn't, end of problem. Yep.
Have you been completed, then,
you get praised? I don't take that seriously either. And if they think you're a saint, see if you've got a halo. No. You're not. So a lot of times that what people say about you, how can they know what you did and what you said and why you said it and why you did it? They don't know all the pressures on you, and whether you're tired or whether you are full of energy and all the things which happened during that day. So just what other people say about me, I don't really take seriously. Because they just don't know, they can't know. They got it wrong too many times. So I'm the only one who criticizes me or praises me. I know if I've done the right thing or been lazy. So I know what I've done. Other people can't. They can't read my mind. They can't get close enough to find out, you know, all of the causes and effects. So that way that other people praise you or they blame you, just take both. It's just so much empty air. So don't take it seriously. But what you know what you've done the last few days. So you know like how hard you've worked within the limitations you've had. So you know, it's okay for you to praise or blame yourself. But even then you think, gee, you know, am I really got all the information? Can I really see it all? Am I just in a bad mood and now I want to sort of criticize myself and now I want to praise myself? So in the end, all praise and blame, you just let it all go. It's a waste of time. Dear Ajahn Brahm, please be kind enough to explain, not self, anatta. There is a you. You are born in this world and reborn again depending on your karma. So is the not a self a perception? I just do not understand it. Thank you. If you did understand it, you will be enlightened and you wouldn't need to come on this retreat ever again. You won't be born again. It's because we don't understand it that we keep getting reborn. We keep worrying about praise and blame. And you know what it does to us when there's no one there. Who's there to praise? Who's there to blame? But to understand how rebirth can happen without a self. Something is born. Something goes through this life. Something dies and gets reborn again. Is it the same or is it different? And the simile I've been using for the last couple of years is the simile of the mango. Imagine you eat this beautiful juicy mango. And when you're finished, you take the mango seed and you plant it in your garden. A few years later, you get a new mango tree. And the mango tree has its first fruit and you eat the new mango. Is that new mango the same or different than the first mango you ate many years previously? If you look, you can see a direct connection between the old mango and the new mango. Every second, every minute, you can see the connection, the way it sort of mutates and changes. How the old mango under the ground starts to rot and germinate, and it pushes its way through the soil. You can see the connection day by day as that tree grows, as it puts forth its branches and twigs, and then it flowers, and then a new mango forms and falls. You can see the connection. Every second you can see the connection. But that new mango and the old mango, there's probably not even a molecule from the old mango in the new one. Even the DNA is different. But it is similar. If the old mango was sweet, the new mango is liable to be just as sweet. Maybe not quite, a bit more, a bit less, because there's always a bit of change. If the old mango was one variety, the new mango will be the same variety. If the old mango tree endured a drought, then the new mango will probably be drought resistant. Can you see how rebirth happens? Every moment of your lives you can see a connection between this moment and the next. Even over death you can see that connection. But the connections are so many, and from one life to the next, so far apart, just like one mango to the next, there's a connection there. And even if the old mango was sweet, then the new mango is as well. If you had an inclination to meditate in your last life, you would have one in this life as well. Maybe a bit more, maybe a bit less. Not quite the same. But there's a connection there. You can see what we call the process. The process of consciousness and the objects of consciousness, which is called life. So we see that yes, life is, but doesn't need to have an essence, a self, or a soul. No more does a mango need an essence, a self, a mango-ness, which is always there from moment to moment. That new mango and the old mango, there's nothing at all in the new mango which is there in the old mango. Everything, 100%, has changed, but there's still a connection. That's called dependent origination, in brief. Now do you understand, anatta? But as long as you have an illusion of a self, you think there's somebody in there, then you're in trouble. Because as long as there is a self, said the Buddha, this is profound, as long as you think there's a self in there, there'll be something belonging to the self. You will attach and possess things. If it's not your family, if it's not your material things, you'll possess your mental attainments, your intelligence, your happiness, or whatever. As long as there's a sense of self, you'll always be possessing something. And that possession is called attachments. The only way to overcome attachments, to really let go once and for all, is to see there's no one here. When you see there's no one here, there's no one left to do any attaching or craving. That is the end of suffering. When I was a young monk, I couldn't stop myself attaching to things. I was a monk, I'd given up sex. Now I was attached to food. You'd eat a lot as a young monk. So stop it, stop attaching to food. Then you get into Pepsis. Stop attaching to Pepsis. As soon as I gave up one thing, I'd pick up another thing. And it was just so hard letting go. You know what it's like in life? You let go of one thing, and then you're attached to something else. So I thought, how on earth am I going to be able to let go once and for all? And then I thought this out myself. I thought, look, what does a hand do? Look at me now. A hand picks up things. That's what it does. Put it down. Stop. A few minutes later, you're picking up something else. Stop it. You pick up something else. You cannot stop the hand picking up things, because that's what it does. That's its nature. The only way to stop picking up things is cut off your hand. If you cut off your hand, you've got no hand left, you will never pick up anything. And that was a simile I used for my own insight. The only way to stop attachments is to abandon the thing doing the attaching. Let go of the sense of self. It's the only way to stop attaching, to cut out the thing which does the attaching, the doer, the sense of self. And I thought that was a neat simile. But one day I was reading the Sanyutta Nikaya and I saw the simile of the hand. Exactly what I just said, but spoken by the Buddha. And that really sent shivers down my spine, still does. Don't know if you got that from a past life, or you found it out yourself. But when you sort of recreate a simile which the Buddha found, ooh, that's spooky. That's true, that's what you do. Understanding that this mind, the sense of self, as long as you have a sense of self and a sense of me, you will have a sense of possession. And it's that possessiveness that causes all the problems in life. You possess your meditation, you have a nice meditation, you think it's yours, you try and recreate it. You think you possess your happiness. Or sometimes you get sad and you possess your sadness. Just allow it to be and let it go. Stop possessing things. When you don't own anything, you're free. Yes.
Okay, is there really any point in renunciation?
Of course there is. Happiness. The point of renunciation is happiness and freedom. But you've got to renounce the right thing. You spend a lot of time renouncing all those things out there. But on its meditation retreat, you renounce the thing in here. You renounce the doer. Which is a hard thing to do. It's easy to let go of your husband, your kids, your house. But to let go of the owner of all those things, that's a hard one. So throughout from the beginning of this retreat, I focused on renouncing the doer, the controller, the maker, the thinker, the planner, the manager. That's what you're renouncing. And some of you have done that to a lesser or greater degree. And the more you've renounced that doer, the more peaceful and happy you've become. The easier meditation and life is. So I've sneakily told you how to really renounce on the path of enlightenment. Not that stuff out there. You can keep renouncing and renouncing, giving things away. How many times do you clean out your cupboards in the house? Clean out all the junk. In a couple of years, it's all back again. Not the same junk, but different junk. That's why a monastery down at Serpentine usually move the monks once every couple of years. They have to change their hut. And the rule is that all of your stuff in your hut, you cannot get the tractor to pull it up or get a vehicle. You can use wheelbarrows, but you have to move it by hand. Just so you realize how much you've accumulated in 2 years. And even a monk accumulates so much stuff within 2 years. And you realize having to carry it from one hut to another how much you've got. Now that's being a monk. I don't know about you. I mean, if you were moving house, would you be able to do it in a wheelbarrow? Gee, you need these huge trucks, about three of them, to move house these days. Gee, and how much have you accumulated? That's why they have these garage sales. And a garage sale is, this is just one house, and the whole garage is full of junk. And that's only the stuff they don't really want, the old stuff, let alone the other stuff in their house. Sometimes you go in people's rooms and you can't move. You know, it's like negotiating an obstacle course to get from one place to another in people's houses. So much stuff. And that's just on the outside. Sometimes I go blessing these people's houses and I open a cupboard and say, please don't open it. Because it's stuff, and if you'd open it, it's a health hazard because things fall out on you. It's amazing how much stuff we have. So you can see that it's very hard to renounce stuff. So let's go to the heart of it, renounce the doer. And then it's very easy to renounce the external stuff when you renounce the internal one. You're at peace, you're mindful. You've had 6 or 7 days, how long is it in this retreat? How much stuff have you got in your room? How much do you really need? You're very peaceful and happy. Having a great time with very few things. So you've learned a little bit of renunciation and how free and peaceful it is not to have much. Usually the joke I usually tell people is, it was shown in research done in the United States of America, if you've got too many possessions or too much money, then you're not happy. Because too much money means too much problems. Too many things to worry about, stock markets, investments, and goodness knows what else, and tax. But if you've got too little money, again, you suffer a lot. So they worked out there must be some optimum amount of money you have. And more than that, you have suffering, less than that, you have suffering. So the peak amount of money was at $50,000 a year. That was the best salary to have. More than that, you suffer, less than that, you suffer. So I announced that once on a Friday night in Nolimara Center. Because I knew that there's many people there earning more than 50,000 a year. And I say, all you who are earning more than 50,000 a year, you're suffering. I can make you happier. Donation box is over there. I tried that in Singapore, it never worked there either. But it's too much stuff, too little stuff. It's too much suffering. Anyway, next one. Is it possible to tell us about the retreat center progress? I don't know what is going on down there. But we're getting the money. Nothing's happening yet. I think the last I knew about before I went on retreat, the architect was putting the plans in for... She said he'd put them in before Easter, so it should be in there now. For the building license. We got the development approval some time ago. The building license is pretty automatic. They just have to make sure the buildings stand up. So you've got engineers and stuff, so it shouldn't be just a formality. It takes about 6 weeks, and then we can start building the retreat center. And fundraising, I think we've got almost 3 million now, but I reckon it's probably about 3.5 we need. So, but you'll be using this. So if you want carpet on the floor, if you want air conditioning, if you want hot water, if you want windows or mosquitoes flying everywhere, you know what to do. But it's coming along. We're doing really well. Ajahn, once you see the nimitta and you get one with the nimitta, the body disappears. Please explain from there on how you attain the jhana step by step. Okay, I didn't go in. Usually on retreats I give a whole talk, just one morning talk on jhanas. I didn't do it this time because I've done it every time. It's in the book. But for those of you who really want to know, once you've got the nimitta coming up, there's two things you have to do with it. Two things you have to encourage. One is stabilizing the nimitta, so it doesn't move around, it's not moving, it's not coming and going, it's absolutely still, it stays with you, and doesn't move. That's number one, stabilizing the nimitta. The other one is brightening up the nimitta, giving it more power, so it gets more and more brilliant, more and more bright. Those are the two things we do with the nimitta. To stabilize the nimitta, that's where you have to pay attention to the one who's watching, so you're not... The one who's watching is the cause of instability. If the one who's watching is very still and not moving, your nimitta is still. Because that nimitta, the light you see at that stage, is nothing more than a reflection of the jitta, the one which is watching. And if the one which is watching is moving backwards and forwards, the image in the mirror will be moving backwards and forwards. If the one who is watching, in this simile me, is absolutely still, you put a mirror in front of me, that will be still too. The image will be still. So to stabilize an image, you have to do absolutely nothing. No movement at all. To brighten up the nimitta, there are a couple of ways of brightening up the nimitta. One of the ways, and I should have really told you this, that sometimes, that some of you, when you first see a nimitta, it won't be all that bright. It'll be sort of grey and blotchy. And that is a sign that your mind is grey and blotchy, which means you have not been keeping your precepts very well. It's incredible. This is actually when you see your mind face to face, no denial is possible. Now, if you're actually living a bit of a heedless lifestyle, or you have been, sort of breaking the rules of this retreat, you'll find your mind is not brilliant. It's, it looks as if it's like smeared with a bit of dirt and grime. I remember the first time I explained this, I think it was on a retreat in KL. And this guy came up to me afterwards for an interview. He said, I got that nimitta, and it was really dirty, an old cloth hasn't been washed for weeks. I said, what have you been up to? And he was very, very embarrassed when he told me. His precepts weren't pure. Which is why the best way of brightening up that nimitta is be a really kind, good, generous, pure-hearted person. And if you're something like that, you really are selfless and kind, and you never say a wrong thing, you never criticize other people, you find your nimitta is naturally bright. It's at that point when I realize the importance of virtue for meditation. If you're a very virtuous person, your mind actually, you can't see it now, but your mind is very, very bright and beautiful. And when you actually get to that stage of meditation where the nimitta appears, you're seeing your mind. You're seeing actually what you've been doing. And if you've been a very kind and beautiful person, your nimitta is incredibly bright and beautiful. If you've been angry at someone recently, that nimitta won't be bright. It'll be dirty. If you've, cheated on someone or broken any sort of precept, it won't be brilliant. So it's important to have virtue. At that stage you see the benefit of virtue. And sometimes I said, because the people in Perth, I know them pretty well, even some of the other people from overseas, and I know exactly what they do and how they behave, and some of them are very, very virtuous people, really good-hearted people, always there to help others. And I know, and it happens, when they get nimittas, they always get the beautiful ones straight away. And they deserve it because they've really been generous, they've been kind, they've been virtuous. I don't mean just generous with their donations, they actually help. They stay behind afterwards and clean up and they arrange things and they cook on retreats and things like that. They've got beautiful minds. Which means that, you know, they think they're wasting their time serving other people. They're not wasting their time. When your nimitta comes up, wow, you're way ahead, it's beautiful. And you get into jhanas very easily. So that's one way of beautifying a nimitta. However, for those of you who aren't so virtuous, you're good enough, but maybe you're not saints in life. You get angry and upset sometimes. There is a shortcut for brightening up your nimitta. And of course everyone's interested in that. And that is that when you have a nimitta come up and it's a bit blotchy, it's not that brilliant, you learn to focus on the nice part. Now the brightest, the more beautiful part of that nimitta. You can only do that when you haven't followed the fault-finding mind. Because the fault-finding mind by nature will go to what's wrong. It will go to the blotchy parts. Because that's what fault-finding mind does. It always sees what's wrong. But with a bit of encouragement, instead of looking at the faults in your nimitta, look at what's right, the beautiful part, the nice part. When you focus in on that, you focus in and it expands, or the dirty parts fall off the screen and you've got the beautiful part. And then go to the most beautiful part of that, and the most beautiful part of the most beautiful part of the most beautiful part. And that becomes a very effective way of shining up the nimitta and making it beautiful. But to do that you have to develop the grateful mind, the positive mind, always looking for what's right, not what's wrong. So you look for all the people who don't speak on this retreat, and you don't see the people who do speak. You know, the food, you see all the food which is to your taste, not the food which you don't like. And so that type of mind will be able to see that nimitta, see the nicest part, and stay with the nicest part, and that grows and becomes more beautiful. So that's the shortcut there. And then when the nimitta is very beautiful and very stable, then that's when you just merge into it. You don't do that, it happens when it's ready. You can't make it happen. Remember, you've got to be so still, the nimitta has to be so stable, and get so strong and beautiful, it just draws you in. And that becomes the jhanas. So you get to those jhanas first of all, and the next stage, I'll let you know what happens next. Or you can look it up in a book. But the main thing to do is nothing. The deeper you go, the less you're allowed to do. And when you go into very deep states, can't do anything. I remain absolutely still. The doer has to be renounced. And when you get to that state of deep meditation, you're having such a wonderful, blissful time. You think, why do I want to keep this doer business? The doer is a pain in the butt. Always making me do things. I don't want to do things, I want to be still. It's much more fun. And the doer keeps on interrupting you. So after a while when you get into jhanas, you realize, yeah, you can let go of the doer. And the quicker you do that, the better. So, that's the answer to that question. So now you all know how to go to jhanas, which is good. You've got 1 day left, so go for it. 1.5 days. Any questions on that?
I'm just going into the jhana.
Go on.
First jhana. Is there just no sense of yourself?
Yep, no sense of yourself in the first jhana.
No decision about any of this business once you go in.
Once you go in, no decisions can be made.
With the sense of...
you're stuck.
Death or finished, no more
need. Sense of death in the sense that you are not there anymore, you can't control anything. That's why that people actually, as I mentioned, the mystics from other religions, they're saying that's union with God, because they've gone, all they've got is power, that's God. I've disappeared. Complete surrender. So they can understand it from that perspective. Of course, it's not what's happening, but there, you disappeared. Powerful mind. The doer has gone. The knower is very strong. And very powerful. Very blissful. Having a great time.
In the second jhana.
Second jhana, there's all of the... there's a last part, like almost like an echo of the doer, called the wobble of first jhana. In the second jhana, that's completely gone. You are absolutely still like a rock. stronger than a rock. Rocks, you know, you can sort of put an explosion and they might vibrate, or the tsunami, or not tsunami, earthquake, they may rock. This is completely imperturbable. Solid. Can't move. Having a wonderful time.
With no sense of time?
No sense of time. Can't do anything. Can't say anything. Can't even... No, can't. So these are great states, and they're interesting, because they're fascinating and they're weird. But don't mind about being weird, because they're great fun. Dear Ajahn, in the Metta chant we say, be frugal in their ways. But whenever I'm depressed or stressed, I become a shopaholic and real spendthrift, buying things unnecessary and regret later. Kindly teach me how to overcome these temptations. Okay, give your checkbook or your credit card to your husband. And you have to beg him for it. I said, why? Because I'm depressed, I want to go shopping. No. And instead, he says, I'm going to send you to Ajahn Brahm to learn how not to be depressed. Because then if you're depressed, sort of, and that's just an outlet, just a distraction. You know, and it's, you're not really getting to the core of the problem. I mean, one of the reasons why people go shopping is because they get in control. They've got the money, they've got the power, they can get whatever they want, and they get all this attention from the people who serve in the shops. You feel you're powerful again and in control of life. But you're missing the point. So let go, because if you're depressed, the reason you're being depressed is you've been controlling too much already. So if you, you know, think you're depressed before you go shopping, imagine what you are when you get the bill afterwards. You get double depressed. So instead of that, just sit down and make peace with depression. Make peace with your feelings. It's a great way of overcoming depression, is to meditate and have cognitive therapy, which is learning some Buddhist wisdom. And many of you know, Mr. Jeff Gallup, he's also the patron of our retreat centre, the ex-premier of Western Australia, who gave up the job because of depression. And he was like a premier, sort of a star politician in this state, and maybe he could have gone on to better things, or worse things, depending how you look at it, in sort of federal parliament. And he gave up the job because of depression, clinical depression. And about 3 or 4 months ago, somebody passed me on this... a copy of a speech he gave in Sydney on depression. And because he's basically Mr. Depression in Australia, because he was a much famous Australian who suffered from depression, his speech was quoting Ajahn Brahm all the time. And how, you know, the cognitive therapy is learned, you know, from, so my book, Open the Door of Your Heart, plus meditation was his strategy to get out of depression. So we got this very, very nice commendation for this particular path you're doing now as a great way out of depression. So that is a wonderful way. Not shopping. Meditation and Buddhist philosophy. And then you overcome depression pretty easily. Better go quick because time's running out. How does the abbot get to know that young monk has performed the act to go to the end of the line? Has he got to confess? No, we've got CCTV cameras in each of the huts. And I review them every morning to see what the monk is doing.
And someone's got to be at the end of the line. Every line has an end. Someone's got to
be... Oh, that's right, yeah. But the thing is, when you see like a monk who normally sits at the top of the line or in the middle line, and suddenly his position has changed. So you know that he's usually up the top there somewhere, now he's down at the bottom, what's gone on? But yeah, there was always confession. Because this is actually the point of being a monk. We don't force ourselves to be a monk or a nun. So we have these rules, and if we break them, we let other people know. It's like the honour system. And as long as, you know, monks really want to be monks, and nuns really want to be nuns, and they want to be trained, they will actually confess these things. And of course, because there's no punishment in the sense of, you know, being beaten or being put in jail, you know, people are open, that they understand that the whole idea is like rehabilitation, to make sure you don't do that thing again. So you want to be trained. If that's a problem, And they come and say, look, I did this, and I'm terribly sorry, I shouldn't have done it. Okay, never mind, this is what you've got to do to help you make sure you don't do it again, to lessen those defilements. So that way, that's sort of they usually confess. But you know, when a person becomes a monk or a nun, they expand all those rules to them very clearly before they begin, so they usually don't break those rules. Because they want to be monks. And if they don't want to be a monk or a nun, then okay, so disrobe and be a good lay person. And there's no sort of shame in that. You know, you've got, for example, Sol. You were a novice for a year. So, you know, if you feel that, you know, you don't really feel like you want to do it, fine, you leave and then you serve in other ways. So that way there's no shame involved. It's much better that you want to keep the rules rather than you feel you have to and you don't really want to. So that's why we have, like, you know, the idea of disrobing. Give it a try, see what it's like. If you don't like it, fine. But if you are going to be a monk or a nun, for goodness sake, keep those rules. Or at least be trying to. Instead of sort of, you know, just trying to get around it somehow or other. Okay, next question. Regarding metta or passing of merit to someone close to you, on Saturday, say 3 p.m. here, would be about 1 a.m. for this person. Do you think this person would still feel something if he is asleep? If it's strong enough, maybe they might have a dream. Maybe you just zap them so strong they jump out of bed. Maybe you say, loving, may you be happy and well, may you be free of suffering, and go zippity doo dah. As if to wake them up. And they say, what are you doing at 1 p.m? They said, I woke up, I'd had a terrible dream. I don't know, but usually choose someone who's awake, very easy. I had many experiences of deja vu. Does Buddhism provide any explanation for this kind of weird experiences? Deja vu. It is a very strange experience of deja vu, and I'm not quite sure what exactly happens. I think sometimes that people actually manufacture, they have the experience now, it's almost they go back and change their perception of what they thought happened. I think psychologists have explained most deja vu that way, but sometimes it's something different. You really have seen what's going on, and it does happen afterwards. So sometimes that occurs, but really I've got no real good explanation for that. So if you've got a good explanation, you can come and tell me. But you know, somehow I thought someone was going to ask that question this evening. No, I didn't. Last question. Is there a way, this is a great question for the last, is there a way to pay back your teacher for what he has given to us? Did Buddha talk about this? Yes, there is. If I have given you anything on this retreat, if I have served you and shown you something very beautiful and wonderful, some great treasure which has helped your life, being more peace, more harmony in your family, more bliss and more freedom, then you're in debt. And the only way to pay that back, the only way, is not to give anything back to me, but to find somebody else who's in need, who's suffering, who needs to know about meditation, who needs actually to solve some of the problems in their life. And you go and give that Dhamma to them. And if you help them, then your debt has been paid. But when you help them and they say, oh, you've helped me so much, can I give something back to you? Say no. Now you have to go and help somebody else. So that way the gift of Dhamma is not just a two-way transaction. I give to you and you give something back to me. It goes on and on and on without end. I give to you, you give to someone else, they give to someone else, and it goes on without end. So that's what Ajahn Chah told me. Whatever he gave me, I have to give to someone else. Whatever you get from me, you have to give to somebody else. You never give it back. You always give it on. And that way, the beautiful teachings of kindness, peace and gentleness keep going on and on and on without end. Oh, what a beautiful way of repaying a debt. That's why the Buddha actually said in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, you don't pay respects or worship a Buddha with candles, flowers and incense. The only way you can worship an enlightened one is by following their teachings. It's just like, you know, if you're a parent or any sort of teacher, you get the greatest happiness when one of your students or your child achieves something which is really, really wonderful because of what you've taught them. And as a mother, you feel, oh, my daughter, my son has done so well. And that's the only gift you need. You don't need thanks. It means that all of your effort has borne fruit. And if you're a teacher, it doesn't matter how hard you've worked, if one of your students does well in life, you think, ah, that's all I need. So that's actually the only way to pay respects and say thank you to your parents, to your teacher, or to anyone else. By making them proud, by following the teachings. So, there is one day left and a bit to pay off your debt. So, meditate well and see what happens. There is plenty of time left, and also you're building up steam. If you haven't got the paycheck yet, of course you don't get paychecks on Thursday, Wednesday, Tuesday or Monday. But guess what day it is tomorrow? Payday, Friday. So, get up early, meditate long, because who knows when the postman comes with your check. If you are mindless, if you are restless, if you are asleep, when the postman calls, he will go away and won't come back to the next retreat. So anyway, take it easy anyway, and have a nice evening.